Welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. Around 20 minutes each month of news, scandal and analysis you won't find anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The Taxcast is available to everyone on www.tackletaxhavens.com. It's also on the Tax Justice Network's website, www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. You can subscribe to our RSS feed, to the Tax Justice Network's YouTube channel, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, look for us on iTunes, or find us on a radio station near you. Coming up on the Taxcast, when was the last time you used or even saw a $100 bill, a 500 euro note, or a 1,000 Swiss franc note? Later, we'll be looking at how Western banks and treasuries are facilitating crime through high-denomination bills. But first, here's a quick roundup of this month's Tax Justice news. The British Virgin Islands is looking at repositioning, evaluating, expanding and diversifying its financial services industry. Apparently, they want to protect and strengthen the territory's reputation as a well-regulated, leading financial services jurisdiction. So, they've commissioned a 9-week consultancy, and you can be sure we'll be keeping an eye on that one. The tax haven of Luxembourg's reputation is causing them problems too. The government there is trying to encourage technology startup entrepreneurs and developers, but they're having trouble attracting them from abroad to live and work there because it's haunted by the country's financial centre and infamous tax regime. Luxembourg's ranked number 2 on the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. While we're on the subject of reputation, the government of the Cayman Islands says it's astounded and insulted. That's because the UK Financial Conduct Authorities put it on a list of high-risk countries for financial crime. The level of prosecutions and convictions there is extremely low. There's only been one conviction since 2006. A few years back, the UK Financial Conduct Authority found around a third of banks there, quote, appeared willing to accept very high levels of money laundering risk if the immediate reputational and regulatory risk was acceptable, close quote. What the UK Financial Conduct Authority didn't do, but should have done, was to include the United States on its list as a high-risk country. The UK is certainly on the US State Department's risk list. Imagine you're an investigator trying to track down dodgy money. Let's say you manage to find the British Virgin Island registered company you're looking for, but then you find that the company's wholly owned by a trust settled in Jersey. Now you're at a dead end, because Jersey doesn't disclose any information about who settles or benefits from trusts. That's why a register of the beneficial owners of companies the G8 and the G20 are talking about is only credible if it includes trusts. And it's not just us saying it. The director of Liechtenstein's Financial Investigation Unit has said limiting the planned register to companies only is, and I quote, window dressing at best. And finally, it looks like almost everyone's up for wider sanctions against Russia because of its perceived aggression over Ukraine, except for Switzerland, because it says it wants to remain neutral. Now, I'm sure the Swiss position has absolutely nothing whatever to do with the relationship Russian oligarchs and Russian finances have with the Swiss banking sector. No, of course not. And that's the Tax Justice News Roundup. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, let's start with Switzerland. So it's summer, it's the sleepy season. Time to sneak in some legal reforms while nobody's looking. And Switzerland's been very naughty indeed, hasn't it? Earlier this year in India, they elected a new prime minister on an anti-corruption ticket. As we know, talk is cheap and it's very early days. But India was actually making already some headway on tackling tax avoidance and tax evasion. Now this new government's made it one of its first priorities to pressure Switzerland for information on the secret bank accounts of Indian tax evaders. And it all looked like it was going swimmingly well until the Swiss amended their laws on assisting foreign nations trying to track down black money stashed in Swiss banks. So what's going on here? What are they up to?
Well, this is, of course, the quiet season, and it's a perfect time for the really tricksy people to slip through stuff unannounced and unnoticed. And this is exactly what the Swiss government and the Swiss Banking Association are hoping will happen. The last Indian government put a lot of pressure on Switzerland to share information. And Prime Minister Modi, when he was elected earlier this year, made similar commitments. But what the Swiss are offering is not full automatic information exchange or any of the kind of FATCA arrangements they've made with other countries. What they're saying is that they will exchange information with India, but with very, very tight restrictions. I mean, restriction number one, because they know that India already has a large database from the HSBC leak. They are saying that they will not support any information requests where they argue that the underlying data has been leaked out of Swiss banks. They will not cooperate. So that's a very major stumbling block. The other thing that the Swiss have been doing for decades, of course, is that the minute that any of the Swiss banks' clients fall under investigation, they tend to give the client the nod, and the client immediately withdraws the account and all the money and disappears. And so the requesting country is no better off if they put in a request for information exchange. Now, although the Swiss are proposing to slightly water down that provision, they're still not going far enough. So this is a very, very tricksy little deal. And as far as we can see at this stage, it really isn't going to be enormously helpful to the Indian government. In fact, the Indian government would probably be better off rejecting this entirely and insisting upon full automatic information exchange with no conditions attached.
Right. So what they're doing, they're basically blocking any information that may have come through whistleblowers. So that's out. And also the onus would be on India to prove they have legitimate reasons to suspect a person of criminal activity. And obviously, it's not always clear whether a crime's been committed until you actually access some of the data that they're requesting.
Well, this is precisely why this deal is so slippery, because without evidence, that is a real smoking gun of an account being held in a Swiss bank and income not being declared on that account, without that evidence, you can't actually make a successful application to the Swiss government or the Swiss judiciary to have the information you need provided. So this is almost a catch-22 situation where without the evidence, you can't proceed. You can't proceed without the evidence. And at the same time, they will not cooperate at all with getting the evidence you need to make the request. So this is a familiar game, a game that the Swiss government have been playing for many years, and other governments, but the Swiss, I'm afraid, are particularly shameless about this. And it's long overdue that, you know, the international community identified Switzerland as a real rogue state in this area. They will put up every single obstacle to prevent other governments from tackling tax evasion. And this is shameful, and it brings shame upon all Swiss people. The Swiss government continually resisted attempts to move towards automatic information exchange on the grounds that this is a fishing expedition. First of all, what's wrong with fishing expeditions? If governments suspect that their citizens are using Swiss banks and Swiss bank accounts to evade tax, then they have every good reason to go chasing after them. And the Swiss should share that information, because after all, if the clients are doing something legitimate, they have nothing to fear from tax information exchange agreements or from automatic information exchange. If, however, they are engaging in tax evasion, then the Swiss should not be supporting them.
Right. And so really, if the Indian government's really serious about tackling this, then they'll be rejecting this deal with Switzerland.
At this stage, the deal carries too many conditions. The Swiss should not be in a position of imposing conditions. India is a powerful country. It should reject the current deal and push for all-out information exchange on an automatic basis with no conditions attached.
Right, and very quickly, we've also seen an interesting development, haven't we, with India and Mauritius. Now, India's share of investments made by global companies through Mauritius has slipped to a historic low of less than 10%. India's been trying to close down possibilities for Mauritius to facilitate all sorts of tax avoidance tricks, and they've been aware for a long time of the use of Mauritius for all sorts of tax evasion and things like this. It all sounds quite positive that perhaps what India's been doing with in regards to Mauritius has actually been paying off, but is this as good a story as it seems?
Well, I'm afraid not. Before anyone gets too excited about this, there are several sides to this story and it's worth exploring them. At face value, the statistics show that investment into India via Mauritius, much of course of this being round-tripped investment out of India and then back into India, hidden behind offshore shell companies, is down enormously. Even in the last 3 years, 33% of all investment flows into India came via Mauritius in 2010, only 9% in 2013. So that's quite a dramatic fall. At face value, it might seem that the Indian-Mauritius tax treaty, which is still forthcoming, has been very successful. But what's happened has been that Indian investors who've used Mauritius in the past are now substituting Singapore. And if you look at the statistics, you see an astonishing growth. There's been a surge from $4.2 billion investment via Singapore into India at the beginning of the last decade to $19.4 billion at the end of the last decade. So over the course of just 10 years, we've seen almost a fivefold increase in investment flowing via Singapore. And that's the big game now. Singapore and India are becoming very closely related. A lot of trade and investment flows to and from India are going via Singapore. What's happening with Mauritius is that not that they're losing out totally. What's happening is that they are beginning to pick up a huge market share for investment flows into Africa. If we look at the last few years, for example, investment flows into Africa via Mauritius have increased enormously and are set to increase even more this year. But we're also seeing huge investment flows and capital flows from Europe to Mauritius and from America to Mauritius. So it's quite clear that Mauritius is developing a much more global market share and is set to continue to do that.
Right, so not as good as it sounds. Let's talk about Russia and sanctions, because it looks like some of the biggest European banks that were already busy vacuuming up the Russian outpouring of cash are going to do even better than they did before now that the sanctions have been stepped up.
Well, all the talk about sanctions at this stage remains largely talk. The truth of the matter is that when it comes to Russian oligarchs holding their money offshore and the capital flight out of Russia, the truth is the horse bolted a long, long time ago. The vast majority of ultra-high net wealth individuals in Russia and high net wealth individuals in Russia have been holding offshore accounts for many years. Capital flight has been increasing. There's been a significant surge in capital flight out of Russia in the last few months, and this will continue. And the losers here will, of course, be ordinary Russian people. And it's fair to say that in terms of foreign policy, the potential leverage of these sanctions over Russia will be pretty minimal. The very wealthy oligarchs who've already shifted their money out of Russia, and the sums involved here are absolutely massive. We're talking about $220 billion of flight capital out of Russia. That's according to the European Central Bank. So that's a massive amount of capital that's blown out of Russia already. They are paying top dollar for secrecy and protection, and the banks know this, and this is exactly the market that most of the big banks and the top bankers crave after. And, of course, the big winners here will be the major banks. Above all, the major European banks, including Swiss banks like Credit Suisse and UBS. So a lot of bankers will be paid massive bonus schemes this year as a result of this huge capital flight out of Russia.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. There are many ways to keep drug cartels, money launderers, racketeers and kleptocrats very happy. And one way Western central banks and treasuries are doing that is to provide an easy supply of big bills or high denomination notes. $100 bills, 500 euro notes, the 1,000 Swiss franc note. The higher the value of the bills, the better. This month, the TaxCast looks at the $1.7 trillion of hidden, untaxed, high-value banknotes. Money talks, money talks, dirty cash, I want you, dirty cash, I need you all. Let's kick things off with an important question. When was the last time you used or even saw a large denomination note? Here's Jeffrey Robinson, author of Laundry Men and many other books on money laundering and financial crime, explaining why high denomination notes are a criminal's best friend.
Consider the now famous 500 euro note. There is no legitimate reason whatsoever for a 500 euro note. None. Now, the reason that the 500 euro note is the choice of the drug traffickers, and if I were a drug trafficker and had a magic wand, my wish would be for a 500 euro note, is because it does everything the drug trafficker needs to do. You know James Bond, how he walks around with an attaché case and says, you know, we have $1 million in the attaché case? Well, you can't get $1 million into an attaché case. $1 million in $100 bills stacks almost 10 feet high and weighs 10 to 11 kilos. It won't fit in an attaché case. You can't get £1 million in 50-pound notes into an attaché case. I know because we actually tried. We did a laundryman program on the BBC, and it took us 3.5 attaché cases to get £1 million stuffed. Guess what? 500-euro notes? One attaché case. €1 million. One. So what the 500-euro note does is reduce bulk by 80%.
Huge banks like HSBC know all too well about the role of big bills in money laundering. Here's Assistant U.S. Attorney General Lanny Brewer.
From 2006 to 2010, the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, the Norte del Val cartel in Colombia, and other drug traffickers laundered at least $881 million in illegal narcotics trafficking proceeds through HSBC Bank USA. These traffickers didn't have to try very hard. They would sometimes deposit hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash in a single day into a single account using boxes designed to fit the precise dimensions of the teller's windows in HSBC's Mexico branches.
The bank admitted its guilt and paid a record $1.9 billion settlement. That's about 2 months of profits. No HSBC official will face any criminal charges. Economist and asset recovery specialist Jim Henry.
Historically, the United States has been providing, facilitating a lot of the anonymous large denomination currency to the rest of the world. You know, I started working on this when I was in graduate school back in the 1970s, and at that point I noticed the fact that there was something like 10 $100 bills outstanding, like $1,000 per capita. At that time, that was, you know, seemed like a lot of money for people to be holding in the form of cash, physical currency in the form of $100 bills, because nobody was using them to purchase retail stuff on the streets. And we had credit cards and lots of substitutes for cash. So the question was, where are they?
Right, and at that time you were calling for a big note recall and for the US government to find out more, I think, on how the underground economy was actually using them.
You know, they had no justification for, you know, the US Treasury and the Federal Reserve supplying essentially this medium of exchange for basically organized crime and money laundering. And at that point, we were just beginning to understand that drug traffic was growing dramatically and there was a lot of currency pouring into Florida and Texas banks. And the Federal Reserve offered, after I wrote this piece, to give me some data on their interregional currency flows, which showed, consistent with this hypothesis, that a lot of this currency was actually flowing in from offshore. you know, it was basically flowing into Florida and border state banks that were associated with drug trade, mainly from Colombia, Central America, Mexico.
Okay, so tell us what's happened since the 1970s.
The last decade, the phenomenon has migrated and changed to include European banks. When the EU formed, the European Central Bank got started back in 2002, they had a decision to make about which denominations to issue. And they could have decided to say, you know, that we're not going to compete for this dodgy business. But instead, I think it was actually Juncker, the current president of the EU from Luxembourg, who was involved in making the decision to introduce not only a 100 euro note, but also 200 euro notes and 500 euro notes. So that made the euro immediately the currency of choice for this kind of international underground economy, including not only drug traffic, but also bribery, lots of kinds of organized crime.
Right, so let's fast forward to today and tell us what the situation is now.
So today there's about 1.7 trillion outstanding of big bills, including nearly 450 billion in euro notes that are 500 euro notes. The estimates vary, but there's maybe up to 900 billion offshore of U.S. $100 bills. And when you look at the countries where it seems to be going, there are places like Russia, Argentina is a big consumer. In the case of Spain alone, the central bank in Spain has accounted for something like 27% of all the 500 euro notes issued since the start of the European central banking system in 2002. And since Spain is only about less than 5% of the entire EU economy, the question is, why are they issuing more than a quarter of all the 500 euro notes, and where are they? I mean, if you ask people in Europe, you know, do you have a 500 euro note? Have you ever seen one? They're not used for retail transactions. And also in the case of Switzerland, the central bank of Switzerland, 90% of Swiss francs outstanding are in the forms of 1,000 Swiss franc notes, which are now worth more than $1,100 each. All of that is basically coming from outside of Switzerland. It's not as if people are running around the streets of Zurich spending 1,000 Swiss franc notes. We have lots of evidence to suggest that much of it is either in the form of under the mattress savings or being used in dodgy businesses to facilitate criminal transactions. It's just the standard means of payment for arms or for drugs or for other kinds of contraband or for bribery. You see the U.S. Treasury, the ECB, the Swiss Central Bank facilitating this with their own denomination policy. And I just find that bizarre.
Okay, and presumably big banks and governments are doing all this because they think they're benefiting from this kind of currency model.
Economists have this concept that central banks basically earn kind of an interest-free loan on any currency that they can get foreigners or the public at large to own. And so, you know, from that standpoint, we have maybe more than $1 trillion, maybe 1.3 trillion of big bills that's offshore. Much of that is either from the U.S. or the ECB. So, you know, you could, if central banks were really just counting pennies, they would think, well, we're able to, you know, that's worth maybe 50 billion a year of interest that we don't have to pay on bonds when you add up the opportunity cost of that. But I think that's really a terrible kind of public policy to facilitate, you know, all the kinds of organized crime and even the non-banking savings that people are doing. You know, this money is earning no interest. It's not being productively invested. The last thing in the world I think the central banks should be doing is encouraging people to use cash as a substitute form of savings. And it's not taxed. So for the cash economy, which is arguably a sector that we should not be promoting, you know, that's not where the innovation is coming from. It's not where taxes are being paid that we need to collect to fund vital public services. You know, I think we ought to cut it off.
Okay, so how do we do that now? I mean, are all these countries really going to agree to stop printing these big bills and start trying to take them out of circulation, given that the US started all this? And now we've got the European Central Bank and the Swiss Central Bank doing the same. Two other major European culprits after Spain being Luxembourg and Austria. And Australia and Canada are joining the party too now, aren't they? So, I mean, what we seem to have now is some very unhealthy competition between nation states in this area.
The thing I'm concerned about is that there hasn't been the kind of collaboration among the leading central banks to reduce this kind of activity. And what I'm concerned about on the margin is that, let's say you have China now thinking about becoming a internationally traded currency. Are they going to be offering, you know, 10,000 yuan notes? Things can get much worse pretty quickly if we don't get this under control right now. I mean, the U.S. Treasury could have decided back in the 70s to do a currency swap or a currency substitution, eliminate the large bill that's not being used for legitimate purposes on its own. But now it requires definitely international accord among the leading central banks that are offering what I'd call reserve cash. I'm not too optimistic about this actually ever getting done. I mean, it would have to be a coordinated migration.
Right. So without this international cooperation that you're talking about, I guess criminals are just going to shop around for their high denomination notes, aren't they? I mean, there are plenty of currencies for them to choose from. What about digital currencies like Bitcoin? Is there any need anymore for packing suitcases full of cash? I mean, that must be quite appealing, surely.
Well, yes, in theory, Bitcoin is the drug dealer's dream. It has no signature. There's no physicality. You know, you can send it through email. It's like dirty money with that's completely electronic and anonymous. In practice, Bitcoin is, you know, right now it's kind of a marginal phenomenon. You know, the U.S. Treasury and the other central banks are keeping their eye on Bitcoin. They understand what a threat that would be to, first of all, their own home currencies. And so I think if it does turn out to be a larger phenomena, you'll see more regulation imposed. In a way that you could say cynically that they're protecting their monopoly against Bitcoin. They want to monopolize these illegal means of exchange.
Right. So governments and central banks know perfectly well there's still nothing more convenient than hard cash in high denomination notes. But these big bills are of no use to ordinary people like me and you. I mean, you're calling for a short-term wealth tax to be administered to this underground economy through a big bill recall. So all existing big bills would be called in and exchanged for lower denomination notes, all on short notice, and those exchanging the notes would need to show their identification. And of course, they should stop printing any more high-value bills. And according to you, there's no better time to do that than right now. So why is that?
I think the good reason to do it right now is that at the moment we have relatively low or even negative real interest rates. So, you know, this is a perfect time in terms of opportunity, all of these central banks to get together and take this stuff out of circulation, because right now they're not really saving that much in terms of the interest that they would have to pay. And there's a certain amount of this demand will simply be substituted into gold or other physical assets, but there's really nothing as convenient as cash. And when we think of all the simple things we can do to have an impact on organized crime and money laundering, I mean, this is one of the simplest things that might be thought of.
If our governments don't act on this, criminals will carry on laughing all the way to their secret bank accounts. You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.